6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. With us on the phone today is Chris Tenzing, who is the Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, MERIP, which is a progressive nonprofit group that aims to educate people about Middle East affairs. He's the editor of its periodical Middle East Reports. Chris Tenzing, I want to welcome you back.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for having me.
The reason I wanted to have you on is that there's been a lot of talk in recent weeks in regard to the 10th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq that occurred in, March 10 years ago. There's been a lot of retrospectives, if you will, in the mainstream. But I thought we'd talk about that, start there today. Chris, what do you see as the key legacies of that war and occupation?
Well, I think the legacies are mostly, they range from disastrous to cataclysmic. I think the first thing we have to mention is the extraordinarily awful toll that the war and occupation and ensuing civil war in Iraq took upon the Iraqi people, not just in terms of lives lost, but also in terms of the terrible and ongoing refugee crisis, which is still a major problem and has now sadly been eclipsed by the horrific Syrian refugee crisis, but there are still many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who are either displaced outside the country or displaced internally inside Iraq, who many of whom will never be able to return to their homes and face all kinds of material hardship and other problems. Politically, in Iraq, the war, the invasion, and its aftermath have been equally disastrous. The U.S. misrule of Iraq during that first period after the invasion, when Paul Bremer was the proconsul, if you will, in Baghdad, set in motion a sectarianization of Iraqi politics, which has proven to be extremely debilitating for the country's politics and extremely dangerous for the region as a whole. And it's important to be precise here. It is, of course, the case that sectarianism was present in Iraq before the U.S. invaded. There have been such tensions there for a long time, and successive Iraqi regimes, worst of them Saddam Hussein's, but also some of the predecessor regimes, have played upon sectarian and ethnic divisions in that country for their own purposes for a long time. So it's not like that phenomenon was not there. But what the U.S. did is that it, when it appointed an Iraqi governing council on the explicit basis of sectarian and ethnic identity, it made that factor the formal organizing principle of Iraqi politics for the first time in modern Iraqi history. And that has been extremely debilitating. It has led, it basically has set up a situation where political parties in the country are set up along that principle rather than ideological divisions or other ways of differentiating different political groups. And on the level of the region as a whole, the Iraq War heightened tensions between Sunnis and Shiites in the region to higher levels than they had ever been since the Iranian Revolution in 79 and perhaps before that. And we see that those dangerous and ugly sentiments surfacing everywhere from Bahrain to, of course, Syria now. So that is also something that has to be described as a legacy of the war. The war didn't create those things, but it badly exacerbated them. and it's a serious part of the invasion's legacy that if it gets discussed here in our media, sectarian ethnic tensions are sort of treated as a naturally occurring phenomenon, something that was that was just sort of is there and has always been there, and we tried our best, but we couldn't overcome them. But that's actually that's the complete opposite of the truth. In fact, what U.S. policies in Iraq have done is badly exacerbated those tensions.
Chris Tensing, in your in the current issue of Middle East Reports, you co-authored an editorial that raised a number of significant themes that I want to get to, but you start off by talking about a quote from Alan Greenspan, that the Iraq invasion was about oil, that taking out Saddam Hussein was essential in Greenspan's view in terms of the functioning of the world's economy. Let's talk, because the first part of that editorial, there's the kind of context for the politics of oil, of geopolitical politics of oil, strategic value, and so on. Talk about that a little bit. That is, there's a phrase that's turned in that editorial about oil as a strategic commodity as well as a commercial one.
Right. I'm not sure if there was ever a meeting inside the White House with Cheney and Rumsfeld and all those guys in which they said, you know, rubbed their hands together with glee and said, "Hey, we've got this grand strategic prize—the, you know, the what could be the world's largest oil reserves after geological surveys have been done—and we need to invade the country for that reason." I'm not sure that the logic was explicit in those terms, but the fact is, and this is not unique to the Bush administration, this applies to all American presidential administrations since the time of FDR. The Middle East is important to U.S. global strategy because it is the site of the world's largest proven reserves of oil and now natural gas. That hydrocarbon treasure has been the reason why the U.S. Formed a strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia, for example. It is the reason why there is a huge military deployment in the Persian Gulf that's perpetual, that began to build up in the 1970s and has just gotten bigger. It's the reason why there is still a military deployment in the Persian Gulf, you know, after the invasion of Iraq and after the U.S. has departed. And the reason, it's not about profits for American oil companies per se, and it's not about ensuring the flow of, you know, of oil to American gas stations per se. What it's about is that oil is unique among the valuable commodities, among natural resources, in that it powers everything in the modern post-industrial economy. It powers industry. It powers all of our personal and public transportation, mostly. It powers global shipping. Everything. Is based in some degree on hydrocarbon fuels and fossil fuels. That is the juice of the modern economy. And in some ways, it's the availability of oil, the availability and cheapness of oil in the starting in the you know, late 19th, early 20th century is what made the very concept of a modern economy with perpetual you know, viewed by neoclassical economists to be perpetual growth and so on. It's what made it possible to envision something like that, this very cheap and seemingly plentiful and very very powerful natural resource that powered industry and communication and transportation and so on and everything about the modern world. So a key prop of the superpower status of the United States historically has been its guarantee to the world economy that the oil reserves of the Persian Gulf will be protected, that there will not be powers there that will seek to impound that resource from the global economy, that it will flow to the world economy And so, and that is why it's a strategic prize, because whichever power guarantees that flow of the oil will be seen as a very important country in the world by those that rely on it. And so that has been sort of a key reason why the U.S. has been very interested in the Persian Gulf, since the 1940s and picking up in the 1970s. And I think, that's a hegemonic idea in the American strategic class. And hegemonic ideas, by definition, don't need to be stated verbally because there's something that everybody agrees upon. And so I think that, that is the presence of oil in the Persian Gulf is just a crucial sort of piece of background to the whole history of U.S. entanglement in Iraq that is simply crucial to understanding why the whole thing happened in the first place. It's not necessarily the immediate or proximate cause of the invasion, although perhaps it was for some. But it's a structural cause. It's not possible to imagine the whole history of U.S. involvement in the Persian Gulf, let alone the invasion of Iraq, without the presence of oil. I mean, I think there's a famous quote, perhaps apocryphal, attributed to Bush's father, in which he said that if the primary export of the Persian Gulf was broccoli, we wouldn't be so interested in the place.
I understand his father didn't eat his broccoli. 256-256-2001. You're listening today to Chris Tensing from Middle East Reports, the editor of Middle East Reports and executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. In that same editorial, Chris, you raised a number of things that I haven't given very much thought to, but this idea that the big oil companies, the majors, have produced at least a sense of oil scarcity as a way of selling what? That the scarcity really hasn't been there. It's kind of goes hand in hand with the current trope regarding dependency on Middle East oil. But the manufactured scarcity I find very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things that have underpinned that. First, it's when it was, some decades ago, when the oil fields were administered directly by big, mostly American oil companies, the supply was kept artificially low as a way of keeping profits artificially high. Companies always pumped less oil than they could have, and that has carried over to the behavior of the Petroprinstons in the Persian Gulf. Since the oil companies were nationalized in the early 1970s, and Saudi Arabia, most notoriously, but other countries as well, have plenty of what's called spare capacity. Saudi Arabia is called the swing producer in that it does not pump nearly as much oil on a daily basis as it has the technological capacity to do, and that is done precisely to keep the supply artificially low to keep the price at a certain level, and so that's one of the reasons why there is this idea that oil is a scarce resource. Now, again, it's important to be precise. Oil, of course, will sometime run out. It is a finite resource. But scarcity, in the sense, refers to the fact that it could have been extracted from the ground at a much higher rate than it has been, and that has a relation to the need of companies to, or the desire of companies to make huge profits. Scarcity is also an important strategic concept as well as a commercial one, because looking forward, if oil is a finite resource, if it's running out in the long, long term, then it becomes even more important for the United States to make sure that it is the country that guarantees the supply. because you wouldn't want a rival power to have that ability. They could theoretically do a great deal of damage to your economy. And so this concept of scarcity, what's often called energy security in the rhetoric of government officials, politicians, think tankers, and so on, is a very important way to market to Americans why it's important for the U.S. to maintain a large military presence in the Persian Gulf.
You know, Chris Tensing, that scarcity, that is the price is kept artificially high, leads to a massive flow of petrodollars, dollars to the oil majors based largely here in the U.S., but also into the coffers of these various largely authoritarian or non-democratic regimes, and then they turn around and buy weapons. Talk about that petrodollars for weapons flow as one of the generators of conflict.
Sure. Well, these regimes, Saudi Arabia being the poster child, are not just non-democratic. They are vocally and explicitly anti-democratic.
Right.
They not only view democracy as poison to their own populations, but they actively try to stop the bloomings of democracy in their neighborhood. And so the power that in the region that was most upset about the fall of Hosni Mubarak was Saudi Arabia. They were screaming on the phone to the White House that the White House didn't intervene on Mubarak's behalf. A major underpinning of the U.S.-Saudi strategic partnership historically, and also the U.S. alliance with other oil-rich governments in the Gulf, is that oil prices have generated these just unimaginably vast sums of money that are frequently recycled back into the U.S. and other Western economies in the shape of arms deals, arms sales to these countries. And Saudi Arabia is, again, the poster child, has spent just an enormous amount of money since the 1990s on U.S. manufactured weapons.
You know, the weapons sales to and the contracts agreed upon with the Maliki government in Iraq are the figures that you laid out are just astounding.
Right. It's 16, I think it's a $16 billion arms deal for the Maliki government of Iraq. And the same logic underpins that as well, that this phenomenal oil wealth that Iraq is slowly coming into as its oil industry recovers, part of that is going to be recycled back into the U.S. economy in the shape of weapon sales. Yes, and so another thing that this does in regional and Middle Eastern politics is that it creates an arms race. It throw Israel into the mix as well, which of course gets a huge amount of military aid, $3.1 billion a year from the U.S. All of which now is military aid, and a large amount of that aid is also pumped back into the U.S. economy through purchases from U.S. arms manufacturers. And so, when you consider all those things together, it sort of creates what might be called a permanent war economy in the region, where these perpetual arms sales sort of generate a pervasive sense of insecurity. The regimes always have to buy more to make sure that they're keeping up with the Joneses next door. This is far from sort of contributing to the stability of the region. This is sort of a way of fomenting structural instability that in turn helps to justify the U.S.'s own military presence in the region.
You know, I want to get back to that whole question of stability, instability, and crisis. But we already have a number of people who want to get in with a question or a comment for our guest today, Chris Tensing. So we're going to go to the phones, take a first caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Panetta didn't get the 4,000 troops that President Obama wanted because they didn't agree to the SOFA arrangement, Status Forces Arrangement. We still have 16,000 State Department personnel in Iraq, 5,000 of which are armed mercenaries. I just wondered if the Iraqis regard this as a covert, continuing American occupation. And my second question is, the Kurdish area in the north has folded the Peshmerga into their own military and they make their own oil arrangements. To what extent do they look at themselves as still a part of Iraq, or how does Maliki and his group or the Sunnis still regard the Kurdish area as part of Iraq?
Thank you, caller.
Well, those are two great questions. I think, yes, a lot of Iraqis, probably not all, but yes, a lot of Iraqis do think of the presence of so many private security contractors and also the super embassy in Baghdad as a continuation of an occupation. And I think Iraqis are very conscious of the tight relationship between the United States and the Maliki government. The U.S., while mouthing all of the pieties about that Maliki needs to reach out to his political opponents that he, in order to heal the sectarian ethnic divides in the country, and that Maliki should form cabinets that are inclusive and representative and so on, it quietly backs him as he goes about behaving in precisely the opposite manner. Maliki has largely built and stayed in power these last several years through reliance on a fairly sectarian Shiite Islamist coalition, which is, certainly elements of which are expressly not interested in reaching out to political opponents and sort of that model of national reconciliation. And so I think a lot of Iraqis view that the U.S. is at least tacitly complicit in maintaining that state of affairs in Iraqi politics. as far as the Kurdish question, the Kurds in many ways have played their cards the smartest of any sort of major political force in Iraq. They have carved out their own domain in the three northern provinces of Iraq, which is really independent in all but name in many ways. The Iraqi flag doesn't fly in many places there. The flag of Kurdistan does. the Kurdistan regional government is, as the caller mentioned, striking its own deals for oil exploration and potentially exploitation of oil fields around Kirkuk, which are the second largest in the country, with Western oil companies, including Norwegian companies and others. And this is a major problem in Iraq because the central government in Baghdad very much opposes these independent deals that the autonomous Kurdish zone is striking. And they have tried to that has caused tensions between the Iraqi central government in Baghdad and some of the super majors like ExxonMobil, which were also in talks with the Kurdish government about deals up there, and that was going to threaten some of the deals that the ExxonMobil wanted in the south as well. So this is a major sort of building structural tension in Iraq going forward, is this fight for oil resources between the Kurdish areas and the central government. And it appears, at least for the time being, that the Kurdish government has the upper hand, in part because another way that they have played their cards very, very smartly is that they now have an unexpected new external patron in addition to the United States, and that is Turkey. In advance of the war, many people, including, I have to say, me, thought that one of the unintended consequences of the Iraq War was going to be that the Iraqi Kurds would find themselves out in the cold because Turkey would be so nervous about their aspirations for greater autonomy in Iraq because of Turkey's own Kurdish population and its aspirations for autonomy, that Turkey would take a very hostile stance toward the Kurds, and the Kurds being landlocked up there would be kind of marooned between various hostile powers. But in fact, what has happened, and this speaks to the wisdom of the Turkish government as well, is that they have formed very tight, and especially economic relations and increasingly warm political relations between the Kurds of Iraq and the government in Turkey. And so the Iraqi Kurds now have this sort of other external patron, which they are able to play off against their political opponents in Baghdad.
256-2001. We have one caller that's been waiting for a while. We'll take that caller, and then I want to return to a couple of themes raised earlier. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like your guest to return to the relation of the Saudis and the Israelis. The Saudis are much older. Roosevelt met with them, and Prescott Bush. Anyway, the relation with the Saudis is older than our relation to the Israelis, and yet we contribute very heavily to both their military machines, but the Saudis are Wahhabi Sunnis, and they have been responsible for much of the jihadism, the opposing the Russians in Afghanistan and so on. And so isn't there also a kind of fundamental contradiction between Saudi Wahhabism and Israeli interests, except with the obviously that the Iranians are Shia? Could you comment on that whole nexus of strange interests? Thank you.
It is a strange nexus indeed, for many of the reasons that you mentioned. The Saudis and the Israelis, of course, are formally enemies. The Saudis give a lot of rhetorical support to the cause of the Palestinians and would like to be, they are not, have not always been, but they would like to be sort of the leader of the Arab world in support for the Palestinian cause and thus at least a very critical stance toward Israel. And theoretically, at least, the Saudis are supposed to be a force pushing for a more equitable and even-handed U.S. policy toward the question of Israel-Palestine. Certainly, supporters of Israel always cite the influence of Saudi Arabia and Washington as their bête noire. In fact, I think if you look historically, there are since the 73 oil embargo, there are really no examples of Saudi Arabia trying to use its clout or its political influence in Washington for the good of the Palestinians or for the cause of broader Middle East peace. In fact, there has been sort of a tacit and perhaps behind the scenes explicit complicity between Israel and Saudi Arabia, the two major strategic partners of the U.S. In the Middle East, to kind of keep the Middle East on a perpetual slow boil, and the Saudis have done very little in practice to alter that situation. At the same time, as the caller mentioned, the Saudis are at least private citizens in Saudi Arabia, and perhaps some with close links to the ruling family have been the primary financial patrons of any number of radical Islamist forces, from the Taliban to Al-Qaeda to the current sort of franchises of Al-Qaeda everywhere from Algeria to the battlefields of the Syrian Civil War. The main funders of some of these little grouplets in Syria that have given themselves jihadi names are in Saudi Saudi Arabia and in other countries in the Persian Gulf, like Qatar. So, yes, this is, and we could also mention that 15 of the 19 hijackers who attacked the United States on September 11, 2001 were Saudi Arabian nationals. None of the hijackers were Afghan. None of the hijackers were Iraqi. So, yes, this is another major irony. And essentially, I think in Washington, historically, the overall role of the Saudis in the region, vis-a-vis oil, vis-a-vis weapons sales, vis-a-vis its overall role as a force for quote unquote stability, which really means instability, and its supposed support for reform, which really means persistence of autocracy. All of that has been worth the price of Saudi involvement in these various jihadi adventures around the world.
You're listening to Chris Tensing, Executive Director of Middle East Research Information Project. You know, that leads into that question I've been wanting to get to, and that is the U.S. strategic interest in what we might call the stability of instability. You referenced it just now in talking about the Saudis, that they actually have an interest in, at some level, in keeping the pot boiling, that they've never been a force for broader Middle East peace. But this whole notion, again, in the piece that we started out on, Iraq 10 years after, this notion of manageable crisis as an interest of the U.S.
Yeah, and it's sometimes hard to tell if it's that manageable crisis is the desired goal, or if it's simply that crisis management is seen as preferable to actually resolving the crises, because the political cost to the local actors of resolving the crises would be prohibitively great. And you know, I'm tempted to say it's the latter. You know, vis-a-vis Israel and the Palestinians, for example. There has never been a major political force in Israel that has really wanted to create a Palestinian state in the West Bank, or to allow the Palestinian people to have self-determination. They would rather pay the various steep costs that Israel has paid over the decades than make that fundamental political compromise. And so we are where we are in that long-running conflict. And with regard to Saudi Arabia, I think you could make an analogy there between Saudi Arabia, the position of the royal family vis-a-vis the population of Saudi Arabia, and also vis-a-vis the populations of neighboring countries, and the ruling family in Saudi Arabia and its allies are not willing to share power in any meaningful way. They're not willing to see the advance of notions of participatory politics or popular participation in governance in any meaningful way. And they're willing to pay the costs, the sort of perpetual crisis that results in. It's preferable to them than to actually resolve the crisis. And the U.S. has abetted this lack of crisis resolution on the part of both of its two major allies in the region for years and years and years. And there's unfortunately no sign that there's any thought in Washington of revising that fundamental strategic calculus. So it seems that the U.S. is also committed to a sort of strategy of crisis management rather than one of conflict resolution.
You're listening to Chris Tensig. You know, one of the things that's at least on the radar of most people here in this country is the fact that, or off the radar, is the fact that the Iraq is faded from the limelight. Certainly Syria has come to the forefront, and you know, continuing on along these themes, might one argue that the instability, the destabilization of Syria might actually serve the interests of the powers we're talking about?
I think that's quite possibly true, vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, for example. You know, we've said that the Saudis and the Qataris, among others, have been funding various little grouplets that make up the Syrian rebellion. But that they have turned the spigots on and off in a way that seems like they're not really committed to overthrowing the Assad regime in toto quickly. It seems that what this might be all about for the Saudis, because they really do see the sort of geopolitics of the Middle East through this sectarian lens. Their bete noire, their real bete noire in the region, is not Israel, but it's Iran. And they see Syria as the major Arab client, along with Hezbollah, of Iran. And so the idea of just pumping a little bit of money into the Syrian civil war to sort of keep it going, and keep the Syrian army tied down and so on and so forth, is basically a way of continually poking Iran in the eye and trying to weaken Iran's sort of strategic depth in the region. I'm not endorsing that way of seeing Middle Eastern geopolitics, but I do think that that is, unfortunately, the way that it is seen in Riyadh. And so, yeah, I do think that that it's plausible to argue that the course of the Syrian civil war so far can be explained that way, with that in view.
It's certainly what you described just now, certainly in my estimation, parallels a U.S. strategic outlook, that indeed the central concern has been and continues to be Iran, and there's in a sense a surrogate war going on in Syria at that level.
Yeah, in a sense, I think there are lots of people in Washington who have that same outlook, and that's certainly the case on the political right, and Obama himself has made statements to that effect, that that a defeat for the regime of Bashar al-Assad is a defeat for Iran. That way of thinking is here as well.
Let's go back again. We touched on it just now, but the Israeli-Palestinian situation. What did that U.S. war of occupation, invasion and occupation, it's had all sorts of ramifications throughout the region. At some level, it opened the possibility of for Israel to act with even greater impunity than it ever has before.
Certainly, those things coincided in time. I'm not sure if there's a direct link between the two. The Palestinian Intifada that broke out in the fall of 2000, I think, does more than the war in Iraq to explain the much more hawkish, militaristic policies pursued by Israel in the last decade. But certainly, and I think we also have to, talk about the September 11th attacks. I don't think it was an accident that the first major foreign politician to appear on U.S. television after those horrible attacks and try to make political hay out of them was the Israeli Prime Minister. Basically said now, Ariel Sharon, who basically said now, a version of now you understand what we go through all the time. And this was, and there has been, certainly in the Bush years, there was sort of this visible, steady identification of the U.S.-led war on terror vis-a-vis al-Qaeda and its affiliates, and the Israeli so-called war on terror vis-a-vis Palestinian groups. And there was an attempt by Israel and by its defenders here in the United States and in the commentariat and in the media to make those two things one and the same in the minds of Americans so that Americans would be more sympathetic to what Israel is doing vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And, you know, to a great extent, that tactic has been successful for a long time, but it, I think, has started to break down with the 2006 invasion of Lebanon, with the Mavi Marmara incident, the attack on the aid flotilla going to the Gaza Strip in 2010. And I think in particular with Operation Cast Lead, the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip in the winter of 2008 really did a lot of damage to Israel's image in the United States and have made people less susceptible to that that rhetorical tactic that had been used by Sharon and others.
Let's return to the phones. We have a caller waiting. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Is that me?
It is.
Yeah, I was very interested in listening to what you were just saying. It's something that I've been following closely myself for many years. However, I wanted to return, if we could, for a moment to the subject of Hezbollah and the Alawite regime in Syria and Iran. I was in Beirut this winter, and one of my reasons was to examine a little more closely through interviews with people Hezbollah's relationship to the Syrian conflict. I don't see Hezbollah as merely the puppet of Iran, and yet I do see that it is clearly in a lot of trouble as a resistance organization with what is going on in Syria. And I wondered if you would comment on that, and then, if you have time, bring in the influence or the effect of what you just talked about, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in Gaza, for example, on the same question, how Hezbollah is being influenced by this regional conflict. Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Sure, I'll give it a shot. There's a lot there. But for the last couple of decades, Hezbollah's sort of strategic depth in the Arab world and in the broader Middle East has been its own rhetorical and active military championing of the Palestinian cause. And Hezbollah's popularity in the Middle East tends to be highest when it is engaged in some kind of visible support for the Palestinians. So, for example, in 2006, when Gaza was under bombardment, intense Israeli bombardment in that summer, and Hezbollah staged a cross-border raid, kidnapping Israeli soldiers and killing some others, and then the Lebanon war ensued. That was kind of the high point, I think, of Hezbollah's popularity in the region, and they were riding high in Lebanese domestic politics as well. By contrast, Hezbollah's Achilles heel in Middle Eastern public opinion is its association with the regime in Syria, which no one in the region is under any illusions about, that about the brutality and utter authoritarianism of that regime. And so both within Lebanon and in the broader Arab world, Hezbollah's standing, its stature, has taken a real beating over the last couple of years, as Hezbollah has been in this position of having to support, rhetorically, and some say by force of arms, the beleaguered forces of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And it's been interesting to watch Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, try to calibrate his rhetoric over the last couple of years to sort of try to split the difference a little bit. But lately, he seems to be moving toward a much more sort of full-throated defense of the Syrian regime and full-throated embrace of Hezbollah's alliance with that regime. And that's that relates to the question of Israel too. And this is one of the things that I think is quite dangerous going forward, is that if the Syrian regime really thinks that it's on its last legs and that it's desperate and it has to play all and any cards at its disposal, one card it might play would be the conflict with Israel, and it might and either itself or through the agency of Hezbollah try to bring Israel into the armed conflict somehow, as a way of sort of objectively identifying the rebels with Israel and trying to exploit that hostility toward Israel in broader Middle Eastern opinion. That's one possibility, and that's another reason why the Israeli airstrikes on Syria have been quite dangerous in that respect, in terms of the possibility that they could be the spark for a broader regional conflagration.
I want to bring in our last caller for the day. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Seems to me after the sequestration, where they want to cut defense so much, they brought on Kerry. Shortly thereafter, then, our foreign policy seemed to have been ramped up more aggressively vis-a-vis North Korea, and then this potentially false flag operation of this chemical weapons thing, where you have people like McCain getting on and talking like it's a proven thing that Syria used chemical weapons against its people. That is yet to be proven. But this, again, is another way for the military-industrial complex, vis-a-vis our foreign policy and Kerry's more aggressive policy, to keep the ring in the cash register. I wonder what your guest thinks about that concept.
I think that's exactly right. And Pentagon officials have already been saying before Congress and to the media that that Pentagon's planning options vis-a-vis potential U.S. involvement in Syria are hampered by the sequester. So, that factor is always afoot in any discussion of foreign policy questions. The Pentagon and its lobbyists always try to exploit those things to keep taxpayer boodle flowing into their coffers. And so that's a factor as well.
Chris Tensing, we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to get your thoughts on the Arab Spring and what's happened since. Some assessment of that, and we got about four minutes left.
Right. I am still cautiously a glass half full guy vis-a-vis the Arab uprisings. For all of the horror and pain that has come from, in particular, the events in Libya and in Syria, but also in Egypt and elsewhere.
Bahrain,
yes. It is still, I think, a epochal, major historical event that peaceful, nonviolent, popular uprisings overthrew long-standing dictators in two countries and inspired a wave of similar peaceful popular protest across the region. Those uprisings and have sort of altered the calculus of regional autocrats, I think, for good. There is no going back, for instance, to father-son successions of power in countries that are nominally republics. There will have to be a a somewhat more inclusive social contract that is drawn between these regimes and the people, even if the regimes do not become things that are classifiable really as democracies, even if they are still hybrid authoritarian states that have some democratic trappings or something like that, I still think that they will be better for the people of the region, and that it is, you know, that it is a step toward a better future for people. However, you know, one has to, of course, qualify that by saying that the cost that has been paid by the people of the region, especially by Syrians, but also by Libyans, Egyptians, Tunisians, Bahrainis, and others, has been very, very steep, indeed. And it it shows that that these authoritarian regimes value not just their own power, but the absoluteness of their own power above everything else. Again, sadly, the regime of Bashar al-Assad is exhibit A for that. They value the absoluteness of their own power above the physical survival of the population.
And the thing that I, you know, can't help to come back to primarily, because my focus has long been U.S. foreign policy in the region, is the you know, continuing fact that the U.S. Has been more than willing in bolstering these authoritarian regimes, you know, well, across the region, especially the oil emirates and the Gulf and the Arabian Peninsula, the major purveyor of violence at that level remains the U.S.
And not just the Gulf states, but also the regime of Hosni Mubarak and the regime of Zine El Abidine Ben Ali in Tunisia. Both of those regimes were close friends of the United States for a long time, and the U.S. Has historically accepted the same sort of logic that those rulers themselves use to justify the lack of participatory politics that basically the peoples of the region could not be trusted to govern themselves, that they're not ready for democracy, and all kinds of really, frankly, racist Orientalist notions that the U.S. yes is complicit in perpetuating
Chris,
in the region.
Chris, unfortunately, we're going to leave it right there, right down to the close of the hour. Once again, I want to thank you. You've been listening to Chris Tenzing from MIRIP, Middle East Research Information Project, and the wonderful periodical, very significant for many, many decades now, Middle East Reports. I want to thank Nigel, and I want to thank Carol on the phones. I want to thank you, as usual, our listeners, callers. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll talk to you next week.